Hey there, it's Brian. You're listening to Bigfoot Show, episode number 48. What you're going to hear today is something a little different. This is the panel discussion that followed the Texas Bigfoot Conference, the recently concluded Texas Bigfoot Conference in Fort Worth, Texas. On the panel were Josh Gates, Kathy Strain, Alton Higgins, Lyle Blackburn, Bill Munns, Daryl Collier, Jeff Meldrum, and me. We were moderated by Mike Mays, who blogs as the Texas Cryptid Hunter on the internet. So this is basically just questions that were submitted by the audience. So we cover a wide range of topics. I thought it was a pretty good deal. I thought it was very entertaining. And my thanks to the North American Wood Ape Conservancy for letting me put this out as a Bigfoot show. Hope you enjoy it. And here it is.
Okay. My name is Mike Mays. I'm a member of the board of directors for the group formerly known as the TBRC. Now the North American Wood Ape Conservancy. You had the opportunity throughout the day to fill out one of these cards with questions for the panel, for the speakers, and for members of the group. So I'm just going to go through there and read them. Some are addressed specifically to an individual, some are to the whole panel. So we'll just keep going right now. And Mr. Gates, this first one is for you. You get to warm us up. What situation has been the most threatening to you during your filming of Destination Truth?
We had the roof rip off of an airplane in flight in Romania, and that is usually my go-to answer for that. When you are flying in a plane and then suddenly you are outdoors, something has gone wrong with your flight. So I think that was probably our night at Chernobyl probably is a close second.
Well, that remains to be seen. That's going to be a long time.
A couple decades.
I think that's a pretty satisfactory answer. That's pretty good.
Roof rips off plane.
There's no way to compete with that answer, dude.
All right, this one's addressed to the entire panel. So anyone that feels strongly about it, please take a stab at it. What do you think is the strongest reason no one has been able to produce any physical proof that the Sasquatch exists?
I'm not going to say I have an answer to this, but I want to differentiate between proof and evidence. There's evidence that something can be, and then there's proof that something can be. And no, we don't have proof, but we have a lot of evidence. So that evidence comes in the form of footprints. That evidence comes in the form of photographs. It comes in the form of unidentifiable hairs and sounds. None of these things are proof, but they are all evidence that there's something there.
Oh, I was just going to say the anecdotal accounts, that's a form of evidence as well. It may not be the most reliable, but it is a form of evidence.
Why don't we have evidence?
Yeah. I'm guessing here, but I'm going to assume what they're really after is why no physical remains, that sort of thing. Anybody elaborate on that?
Okay, this is sort of an analogy of an answer. It's really it's something that I was actually talking with two of the ladies that are sitting there now last night at the smaller meeting that we had. And I was talking about how there are these like brain teaser puzzles, these little entwined pieces of metal. And you pick it up and you try to unhook the two pieces of metal and you can play with it for hours and you can't make it work. And then somebody comes along and says, well, you just twist it and you slide it and it's solved. And you watch them do that, and you wonder, why didn't you see it those hours you were trying to untangle these two squirrely little pieces of metal? And what, for myself personally, in the whole Bigfoot phenomenon, I know it's a mystery, I don't have an explanation for it, why there isn't more advancement, physical remains, and things like that, I have no explanation for, and it does confound me, because I know Patty's real, and there's got to be more of them. And if there's more of them, sooner or later, there's got to be evidence, and I don't know why. But I have a feeling it's like this analogy of this little brain teaser puzzle. It's like, we're looking at it, we're trying, and it's not working because there's one little twist that we don't yet understand. And I think when we understand it, suddenly the evidence will start appearing. And then when we look back on it, we'll realize we just didn't see one part of the puzzle. Now, exactly what the part is, we won't know until we see it, of course. But there's just one little piece of the puzzle missing, and when we have that one piece, the physical evidence will start showing up. We'll know where to look, we'll know what it is, we'll know how to determine it, we'll know how to separate it from something that's faked. And once we reach that point, suddenly it'll all become clear why we had so much trouble finding the evidence before. So for me personally, that would be how I would look at answering that question. We know it's a mystery. We know we haven't figured it out yet. We're just missing one little bit of the pieces. And when we have it, it'll all come together. And we'll be able to untangle the mystery effortlessly. So that's my shot at it.
I would just add, well, that's very true, and if you apply that in a particular way, where that part of that equation isn't necessarily mystery, but just a lack of information, and some of that information we actually have. We have physical evidence in the form of hair. There's no question that something is shedding hair that continues to defy attribution to any commonly known wildlife. That bears remarkable resemblance to human and other primate hair. We've been stumped because of a set of circumstances associated with the very nature of that hair in trying to derive DNA from those samples. It's proved very challenging. Now, technologies have advanced. Like I said, while unfortunately I think the water is far too muddy with the Melba Kitchen study to salvage anything from that situation at the moment. I'm very hopeful that Dr. Brian Sykes' techniques of digestion and elution of DNA from problematic, troubling hairs, you realize, here's the simple explanation, just by way of background. Hair is dead tissue. The living, dividing cells are at the follicle, at the root. Most of the hair that is shed naturally has a quiescent or an inactive follicle. When you find hair in your brush or in your drain in your shower, that's hair that is simply falling out because the follicle has shrunk up and the hair slips out and then a new shaft begins to grow. And that's happening all the time with you and other animals. So much of the hair that's found out in the environment doesn't have a clump of rapidly dividing and growing cells at its root. And so we rely on the cells that are stacked up in the central core or medulla in order to derive hair. But some animals have an acellular medulla, a core that is essentially hollow, that has no stacked up dead cells. So all you have is a keratin shaft, which is the husks, the remains of dead cells stacked together with very little DNA, if any DNA. But recently, advances have improved the probability of getting DNA out of that very, very barren hair shaft. And those techniques are being employed by Dr. Sykes right now. So of those 30 hair samples that he has, hopefully something will be forthcoming. But as far as other physical remains of a corpse, it's really not that mysterious. If you talk to people who are familiar with the circumstances of the fate of remains of animals in the wild, it's not really surprising. We haven't found the remains of a very rare, very large, very long-lived animal. An animal that would be at the top of its food chain, would have no natural predators, for which a population for which a death would be a very rare event. And when it occurs, since it occurs naturally, those individuals secrete themselves off in out-of-the-way places. You know, I often cite, we had a cat one time who got in a fight with a neighbor cat, and he got the worst of it. And he disappeared, and he was gone, we thought. Not a sign of it for 3 days, until the fourth day he emerged from under the master bedroom bed, where he'd been hiding, licking his wounds all that time. So animals will do that when they're old, when they're decrepit, when death is near. They tend to secrete themselves off somewhere.
unless they're taken by a predator. And then secondly, you combine that fact, that natural history fact, with the organic or biologic and abiologic factors of the environment in which we find them, which is principally wet coniferous forests, oftentimes in the Pacific Northwest, in volcanic soils, both of which contribute tremendously to an acidic environment. Bone is made up of alkaline materials, and acidic environments quickly decompose them. So what the chewers and gnawers and pack rats don't carry off is quickly deteriorated and dispatched by the physical elements of the environment themselves. You know, I often point to the fact that we have a giant ape on the order of a Bigfoot that occupied eastern China for 1.5 million years. Now think about that, 1.5 million years. And yet for that entire tenure, we have what to show for it? We have two jaws and about 1,000 isolated teeth, all of which are found in karst caves, in limestone caves, where they had been carried by porcupines. Now, in China, porcupines are only below the Yellow River. There are caves in the northern part of China, but there are no Gigantopithecus fossils from there because you're missing one of the two critical elements to concentrate that skeletal remains. You're missing the porcupine. If it weren't for the action of that porcupine, we would know nothing about this gigantic 1,000-pound ape that persisted for 1.5 million years in China. So there's a lot of biases in the environment. There's a lot of reasons why we don't necessarily have remains of a sasquatch.
Jeff?
I was going to say everything that Jeff just said.
You would have said it much better.
I just want to add to that, the other element that was necessary for that was that humans had to find it. So there is this great perception that there is this grand search for this species. That is not the case. It's never been the case. There's just not this huge amount of people that are out searching for this animal. Go to the Big Thicket National Preserve in Southwest Texas. Ask them for a permit to conduct Bigfoot research and see what they tell you. We know firsthand because it's happened to us. So there's just, you know, the search is not there. There aren't very many people doing this, and it's never been that way. I mean, Benjamin Radford talks about all these people. Benjamin Radford's a known skeptic. Talks about all these people throughout the last, you know, 4 or 5 decades that have conducted this great search. But when I ask him to, you know, tell me who these people are, he can never listen. So that's another reason. It's just there's no funding, and there really is not any sort of coordinated search.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Statistically speaking, nobody's looking for Bigfoot. Nobody. I mean, you've got 50 people in the NAWAC, half of which are going out on a regular basis and doing it. That's 50 people. Maybe there's another 100 people in the state of Texas doing it as much as we are. I don't think there's anything more than that. So why don't you find it? Because statistically speaking, nobody's looking for it.
One more reason. I think that, yes, why? I think the one why is ignorance. Not to be insulting, but I think it's, you know, very likely that there have been people who have stumbled across the bones, the skeletal remains of a dead wood ape. But you have to have someone who recognizes the significance of what they're seeing. And unless it's a skull or something, the bones that they see, I don't think that the vast majority of people would recognize the significance of the bones. They, big animal is dead.
And I think people underestimate the animal as well, and that plays into it. You know, people have this, in the general population, have this perception it's a big, lumbering, slow creature. That's entirely untrue. And if you look at some of the more credible reports, you look at what these guys are seeing. These animals are highly intelligent, they're very fast, they're efficient, and when they want to get out of sight, they can. Everybody says, oh, everybody's got a cell phone camera. How hard would it be to get a picture? I'm like, do you walk through the woods with your cell phone out like this? Try to get your cell phone out and take a picture. It takes a few seconds. By then, this animal's gone, and it's moved into the woods. So you're up against a small population of these, a very rare sighting. You know, you won the lottery, you get to see it, it's 2 or 3 seconds. You don't have time to to respond that fast. So it's not as easy as people think, even though we do have technology and stuff on our side. So we're still at a disadvantage against them in their home territory.
One last thing, on the point of the camera. You can do this at home. This is a little homework experiment. If you've got a kid, it's perfect for that because they can be your Bigfoot, right? And what you can do is you can have a camera sitting on the table next to you and have it turned off because you're probably not going to leave your camera turned on all the time. And then have them just at random moments run out from behind a couch or something and count how many times they do that before you can actually get a picture and how long they have to be visible to you before you can grab your camera, turn it on, pull it up, focus, and pull the picture. I mean, as everything we've experienced, these sightings happen in moments. They're over in seconds. So you're talking about something that has to go on for 10, 15, 20 seconds. Those kind of encounters just don't happen, or they happen so infrequently as to be, you know, just not that big of a deal. So that's the other part of it.
Especially during the day.
And then, of course, you have to have light. Exactly right. Right. You have to have light as well.
I should point out that's probably the only kind of research you should practice on your children. Okay, here's one basically directed at our group. With as many rock throwing incidents as we've experienced during operations, endurance and persistence, are there any plans to put up cameras around the cabin in the surrounding close by areas? If so, could you go into that? If not, why not?
Between 2006 and 2013, we invested roughly $50,000 in the best cameras that are commercially available. I will tell you now, we have zero pictures of this animal. It's one of the things we don't know. We don't know why. Incredible good luck on their behalf, incredible bad luck on our behalf. Maybe they are wary of cameras. Alpha Coyote males tend to be. There's some recent studies that show that. Maybe that's the case. Maybe it's a combination of camera technology is still not where it needs to be. And I can say that with some authority because I've watched a black bear for 2 minutes stand and just move around, sniff between three Reconyx cameras right in the center of them. And I'm not the only one that saw it. Mike Mays was there. Todd.
$600 cameras.
Three $600 cameras. And guess how many pictures we got of that black bear? Zero. We've had instances where we've walked in front of the cameras to change the cameras out, and the camera doesn't get a picture of us. So, you know, it's very, very, very frustrating, but I will tell you that we've sold almost all of our cameras. We've only got a few left. Now, we're looking at some sort of surveillance system, a passive surveillance system. It's not triggered by heat. It's not triggered by motion. It's constantly going. Hopefully, you know, that'll provide some footage. But, you know, as many of you know, there are a number of us who don't believe footage is going to, it's not going to do the trick. So, science requires a specimen.
What we would use the cameras for is to understand how they're moving around the cabin. As we know they're out there, we know they're moving around. Whether it's a cabin or a tent or whatever, in this case it's a fixed structure, so we can attach cameras to it. We need to know that how they're doing it. It's part of what's going to ultimately solve this mystery. So we're looking at different systems. Of course, we have problems out there with electricity. We've got all kinds of sort of environmental issues. It's a rough environment, so it has to be sort of a hardened unit, so it's not going to be the cheapest one you're going to get off the shelf. But we are looking at that technology, and hopefully a successful conference will allow us to pick something like that up.
We invested last year, for Operation Persistence, we invested in a really high dollar... The solar power generation system. And I got to tell you, after 3 days, we were ready to kick that thing into the river, into the creek, because it wasn't keeping up with our power requirements. We couldn't keep the stuff charged. We couldn't keep, you know, our own personal cameras charged. We couldn't keep audio equipment charged. So it's quite a challenge in an environment like that. You know, you're on a shoestring budget, and you're trying to keep everything operating, and it's quite a challenge.
Say that the one way we could raise money is by field testing people's company's equipment. We had one of these things hooked up to a solar thing. The battery was full charged. I plugged my computer in and it was sucked to dry in like 8 minutes. I mean, it was gone.
Yeah, running laptops.
Yeah, running laptops off of it, you can't. So, I mean, electricity is a huge challenge for us out there.
I point out, too, we're operating in an area where we know there are mountain lions. We've never gotten one picture of a
mountain lion either, and they do exist. So I hear.
Crazy people think that. Okay, Mr. Gates, this is for you. Have you ever realized you were being intentionally hoaxed? And if so, what did you do about it?
Only once we did a story on the lizard man of
South Carolina.
And I am here to tell you that I do not believe in the lizard man of South Carolina. But I did, it was a really interesting thing. We went there and we started talking to all these different people, and the story kind of became clear. At least to me, it became clear what had happened, and then it became very clear off camera what had happened. But it felt in the end like doing an expose on Bishop, South Carolina, you know, which has a kind of eking out a little bit of tourism and stuff off this. I think kind of, you know.
Did you meet the retired sheriff?
Oh yeah, Liston, Truesdale. That was the only time that I think we sort of knowingly were being played a little bit, but in the end it felt like it didn't really seem like the nice thing to do to sort of tear that story down.
I was invited to be an expert consultant on another story, a similar story, or the same place, but a different documentary. And they provided me with pictures of this footprint. And if you haven't seen it, it's this strange lobed, multi-lobed thing that ends in three segmented toes that radiate out and then have these very sharp, incisive marks of quote-unquote claws. And so I had enough time to prepare, so I put together a little flip book that had some basic introduction about, first of all, the reduction of digits in animals that become more and more cursorial or adapted to running, that move from having their heel on the ground, plantigrade, to digitigrade, to unguligrade. And I showed how an animal that had only three toes would not have a flat foot. I mean, it would be unprecedented. And I even had a whole litany of illustrations of claw marks, bear claw marks on trees, cave bear claw marks in clay, etc. Especially ones in clay were interesting. Showed the anatomy of the claw with its ungual and subungual, and how it has this kind of hollowed out area underneath, and it has a very distinctive pattern in the way in which it claws. And so I'm flipping through and explaining all this to the good retired sheriff. And I pointed out, I said, you know, honestly, these don't look like claw marks at all. They were made by a Bowie knife. And I said, I have to say, I'm just afraid that there's no credibility to this. And he just looks at me with this big old southern smile and said, well, thank you very much, son, for your help. Really appreciate it. And
yeah.
Then later, I mean, over in the corner, the producers are sitting there trying to stifle their laughter, and they came up to me afterward, and they said, oh, that was great. You did a great job. He said, we already knew it was all hoaxed. The deputy who was responsible for making the tracks had already admitted it to us. And the guy that was claimed that his trim on the car didn't shoot up and ripped apart was in jail, so he couldn't appear on the camera. It was either the neighbor's dog or a raccoon that didn't shoot up the grill. So it was quite a time. I was in their team. But you're right. Apparently the sheriff had gone around town and said, okay, just go along with the story. This is
right.
Great for tourists.
Yeah, I mean,
there's like a lizard man parade. One of the footprints is like in the local bakery. Like, you can't, like, it's heartbreaking. Like, you can't, you know.
Well, I had an experience with the sheriff who didn't believe my story for once, but. Okay, Kathy, this is for you. Is there any evidence of tool use by Bigfoot similar to that you see in chimpanzees or possibly even more advanced tool use than that?
Not that anybody's identified. So I spent 8 days in Area X and I took a good look around the area. I actually didn't see any artifacts at all, even human-made artifacts, except for one strange possible petroglyph But there was no evidence of any kind of grass use or stick modification or anything like that.
Well, except the rocks themselves and the, whatever they hit the trees with, or tools, right?
Right. And Kevin, maybe you could just, what would be a loose definition of a tool? What constitutes just a stick on the ground versus being a tool of some kind?
It needs to be modified. And so simply picking up a rock and clanging them together, it's not modified. You're using them, two objects, not changing them in any way. And so it's not enough to prove that you have the function of a mind to make tools. I'm not saying they do or don't. I don't know. But I didn't see anything like that. I know at one point a piece of firewood had moved from the deck at a patio and was moved over to an area and laid against a tree. And when they demonstrated the firewood up against the tree, it made the exact same sound of a tree knock that people had been hearing. And so that's very clever, but they didn't modify firewood in itself in order to create the tool.
So Kathy, would be if they tore a limb off of a tree and used that to hit the tree, would that be the modification you're talking about?
It would be primitive enough. Yeah. I mean, it's they trying to create something, they didn't just pick it up off the ground, use it, throw it back down.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Meldrum, this one's for you. And I'm assuming this is referring to one of the Monster Quest episodes that you appeared in. It says, are you going back to the cabin where you had the most Bigfoot action, rocks were thrown, etc.?
Well, after the episode in which the rocks were thrown at the cabin, we did go back. But it was a very different set of circumstances. We were a little bit earlier in the season, and that spring was unseasonably cool. And people had commented, as we drove up through Minnesota, the blueberry festivals were all frantic because they were going to have to actually truck blueberries up from the south because they hadn't ripened yet.
Well, isn't that something?
Well, it had impact. It had impact on us because when we got up into central Ontario, the understory, which was about 20 to 40% blueberry, weren't even in flower yet, and so there was no ripe fruit. And as a result of that coolness and low productivity, there was very little wildlife activity. I mean, it just had a sense of being deserted. And so after days and days, we had all these grand schemes of these observation tents and blackouts and things and surveillance cameras attached to every corner of the cabin. Nothing was happening. And then it happened that one of the pilots stopped in to pick up some fuel. And he said, oh, yeah, there was just a story on the radio that there was a sighting at Grassy Narrows down on the reservation, which was about 250 miles southwest of us. So, after a little inquiry, we pulled up stakes and we headed south and went and investigated that. It was a very good, very credible visual contact by an elderly woman and her adult daughter who were on their way up to pick blueberries. They were right then there. There was a big clear-cut area that had overgrown with blueberries. I mean, it was beautiful. It was the luscious growth of berries I've seen. And on the way up, they had a sighting. Saw this creature walking down the road. As soon as it saw the car, it just veered off the road into the brush. Her adult son came up that afternoon and to the approximate area and found some tracks, which they were. He made a cast of. They turned out to be bear, unfortunately. And but they're. I do think, based on the interview of the two women, that their story was very credible. There were bear tracks all over the place. Couldn't help but stumble on bear tracks because they were attracted to the ripe blueberries as well. So I just chalked it up to the fact that he stumbled, he stopped at the first tracks he found, which happened to be bear, and there was a good overstep print that gave the impression of an elongated Sasquatch track that it was very easy to point out the characteristics that distinguished it. So I'm asked this repeatedly. Well, in follow-up on that episode, they did send some of the evidence, some of the tissue that was collected on the first episode for a follow-up. But by that time, the results came back as bacterial DNA. There was no primate DNA to be extracted. And so It had degraded beyond. I mean, I was amazed that they got anything the first time. And I actually questioned whether that might have been some contamination due to the extensive handling of the specimen. You have to realize that some screw board was leaning up against the cabin out in the elements for 2 years before we examined it. And so it had been exposed to the weather, the elements, the UV radiation, the sunlight. And I didn't expect them to find anything. But I don't think there's any magical about that cabin, and I have no plans to go back. It's just I think that every once in a while, once in a blue moon, they get lucky because some of the animals that are conditioned, they have this unusual habit there of when the tenants check out of the cabin, rather than carry out all their perishable foods, there's actually a posted sign right there by the refrigerator that says, throw all your perishables, bread, vegetables, fruit, out behind the outhouse, which is about 50, 60 yards behind the cabin at the edge of the forest. So you know, it wouldn't take long to condition a few animals, bears and maybe Sasquatch in the city. When you hear a float plane go by, that means that in the next day or two, there's going to be a whole smorgasbord out behind the outhouse. So let's go check it out, you know. But I wouldn't. I've had people suggest that they wanted to rent the cabin for the entire summer. I says, well, I hope you like to fish because you're going to have a lot of time on your hands. You can't go anywhere in that terrain. It's just, it's extremely, you know, you talk about your thick jungles. This is just crevice and crack and filled with moss. And I mean, you can see it's a couple of shots on the documentary where I'm walking out to put up a camera and just about break my leg stepping in a pothole. So travel is purely by river or by boat on the lakes and the portages. So it was an interesting place. Great, great place.
The next one is for Mr. Munns. If push came to shove, could you or someone else have created the Patterson-Gimlin footage? And it's kind of a part two. What is the earliest known use of costume skin that could stretch and compress in the special effects field that you're aware of?
It's marginal if a perfect patty could be done today. The head is still problematic. It's small, and the only thing we can do when we make a mask is to add to the head of a human being. So we try to make something look smaller by adding somewhere else. The head gets bigger. Patty's head is remarkably small and compact for her body, but it's very non-human in its form, with a heavy brow ridge and another head going straight back. So that part of Patty probably still couldn't be done today with any of the technology that we have, and get it to human and get it to look right. The rest of the body could be done. It would certainly not be easy. It would take a remarkably talented person or team of people, because actually there are very few makeup artists who actually can do everything start to finish. Nowadays, almost everything is done by teams of specialists. One sculpts, one molds, one casts, one figure finishes, one does the hair work, one trims and paints it, one does the paint job, and so on. So it's actually rather rare for even one person to have a complete skill set. But if they were to attempt it today, even with all the material advances, more sophisticated than what was in 1967, I would have to say the head is still all but impossible if you really are talking about getting the right size and the right shape and duplicating what you see in the film. I'd still say, there's your stumbling block. Everything else I pointed out in my presentation, we could probably work around it today and somehow make it work, but it wouldn't be easy. It would take a remarkable amount of skill. But the head's still a problem I have no solution for. And trust me, in the last 5 years, every day I've looked at that picture, I've said, okay, it's a hoax. How would I do it? And I keep drawing a blank. So that'd be my question number one. I don't think anybody can figure out how to make the head the shape and size that it is in proportion to the body. In terms of materials, all of the new materials, the stretch materials in terms of stretch fur, and there are a lot of resinous compounds now that could produce a breast prosthesis that has the motion that you saw. Rick Baker used it extensively on a movie called Norbit when he made Eddie Murphy play himself as well as his fat girlfriend. and that full body suit was made out of these resin compounds that the BJB company makes. And they were remarkable in terms of the flabbiness and their responsiveness to gravity. So those things are available now, but those resin compounds didn't even start being introduced until the late 80s and didn't become well refined until the 90s. The stretch fur that you would need to do anything that would be close to what we see on Patty, National Fiber Technology developed it roughly around 1984 and introduced it to the motion picture industry and thereabouts, and started to become successfully popular in the middle to late 80s, which is almost 20 years too late. So in 1967, materials weren't there, and that is a big strike against, you know, any possibility of a true costume back then. But even if we were to try it today, the head is a problem. And I really haven't given it a lot of thought. I still haven't got a solution for it. Unless you can find somebody who's really just dying to break into the business and doesn't mind having a massive lobotomy in order to get in the film. Yeah, that's about it. Yes.
A lot of people probably know that Philip Morris claims to have made the suit that Roger Patterson used because he was a maker of costumes, gorilla costumes. I actually interviewed Philip Morris about this and challenged him on some of the aspects, but suffice to say they tried to recreate the suit. Even Blowhard Philip Morris tried himself, in which they were going to air, I believe it's on National Geographic, so he made this new suit that was supposed to be just like what he was making then, although it didn't look anything like the gorilla costumes he was making back in the 60s, but in that film they were going to air it, this was going to blow the whole thing. Well, it looked so horrible that they do a documentary right up to the point where they're going to show you his new, brand new suit that's going to disprove the whole thing. They show the Patterson film because the thing looked so bad. It looked bad. So it's a TV show. It's entertainment. They end up showing the Patterson film. So needless to say, even Philip Morris, who claimed he made the suit, could not even reproduce the suit in, you know, recent times. There you go.
And no one's been able to show us that suit either.
He told me he knows where the suit is, and it's in the hands of some, he wouldn't give me a name. I said, well, man, if you show me the suit, we could solve it right now. He said, well, maybe sometime, you know, that person wants to come forward, but so far they don't. Never show me the suit or sit. Yeah, I think that was it.
Okay, this one is a question for Brian Brown and Dr. Meldrum. Now we're getting in. Is the taking of a specimen necessary to prove the existence of Bigfoot to science? And if so, do you advocate the taking of said specimen?
I'll go first. I'm not a scientist. But I can speak to what I have learned in trying to answer this question myself. I think that it is possible to prove the existence of an animal without taking a specimen. I think that the problem is when you go beyond that, when you go to say, well, let's just get some DNA. There are issues with DNA. There is, as I sort of touched on in my presentation, you have to have a provenance of that DNA. What is the chain of custody of that DNA? Some DNA, depending on how you got it, has a shelf life. Scat, for example, I think Dr. Melton talked about that. You have to get that preserved in a certain amount of time. So what happens is, when you move away from that, you start finding yourself in a sort of a smaller and smaller circle of opportunity. And so, while I'm not going to say it's impossible to establish the species any other way, I will say that the most efficient way to do it would be through the taking of a type specimen. I'd also say, from what I understand, I think Professor Holman can speak to this better than I can, but in those very rare cases where animals have been listed through not taking a specimen, ultimately a specimen was taken. There must be a type specimen. That's just how it works. So even if you can establish an animal without the type specimen, eventually it will be taken, whether they find a dead one or they go and make a dead one. That's how it works. So And it probably won't just be one. But that's the that would be my answer.
Well, by the conventions of zoological taxonomy, a type is required, and that needs to be a body or a diagnostically significant portion of the body. However, there has been discussion in the literature, in the conservation literature, and I'm particularly aware of issues involving primates, where authors and papers have argued that given the endangered status of so many newly discovered species of primate, that perhaps we should we should move beyond the sort of Victorian era ethic of shoot first and ask questions later, and accept as a type specimen a voucher sample of DNA that is accessioned to the museum. And so that debate is ongoing. It certainly is not established. And Sasquatch may, you know, if Dr. Sykes is successful and some novel DNA sequences are clearly incredibly demonstrated, while there isn't a standard against which to compare those, we can compare sequences, and based on various traits, we can establish what its nearest neighbors are. We can establish where it fits into the phylogenetic tree. Go ahead.
I just have a quick question. Let's say you did actually have a body, had an opportunity, had to defend yourself, whatever reason. What would you do with the body? It's now shot.
Yep.
They're on the ground. You have it. What do you do with it?
Take it immediately to A&M.
Well, it depending on your circumstances. I mean, if you're able to get assistance in and alert the necessary authorities or whatever. Well, that's a good question. I mean, if you're a conspiracy theorist, then maybe you don't want to contact the local fishing game, or and so you may want to go to a trusted academic contact and work through those channels. If you're in a situation where you can't, you know, it's remote and you can't, or you don't feel you're safe to remain there with the body, then I'd say, you know, get a portable chunk of it. And in the case of diagnostic, I mean, if you have a lot of tissue, obviously that's going to be the critical thing, because it will be the DNA. But a jaw that has molar teeth on it. I mean, traditionally, the morphology of molar teeth has been the basis of much of primate taxonomy. And you could certainly establish a novel species and its affinities with that type of a specimen.
Take the hat at that point.
Yeah.
No reason to mess it up.
Yeah. We've drawn up a protocol just for that situation. We're going to leave with a minimum of the head. That's the bare minimum we're going to leave with. And if we have a set of protocols, we have drawn up a list of contacts and a set of actions that we're going to take. And that's what we're working toward.
You just consider the logistical challenge of moving 800-pound massive flesh, right? And it's going to be difficult. Now, we have in place equipment that you use to move big animals.
The facility
and so forth. And we have a place to take it. We've got as Daryl alluded to, we know what we're going to do when it happens. The only question is how much of it can we get out? And that really depends on where it is, and it depends on other environmental factors, if you take my meaning. So we've worked through many scenarios. You come up with plans, contingency plans, because you know that things aren't going to work out the way you think they are. But we've fought it through a lot.
Actually, from a question just a moment ago, it kind of inspired me to want to ask Jeff a question. With the DNA thing. Let's say you get a hair or a drop of blood. Let's say hair, for example, and comes back unknown primate, but it still has a DNA sequence that could be identified, right? Mm-hmm. So you could basically chart it out and say this unknown primate has this DNA pattern. Now, let's say you have a second hair or some other biological aspect, drop of blood or something like that, and the DNA pattern comes back matching the previous sample. It's the same species as the share of unknown primate. I'm just wondering if there were enough reoccurrences of that same unknown pattern to say it is a species, and there are multiple biological examples of it. Do you think that might be sufficient to get a recognition of species?
Well, it could potentially. And in fact, we've sort of done that exercise with the hare based on its own morphology. Back when when I first sort of struck up an acquaintance with Dr. Fehrenbach, and we were comparing notes and ideas, and one of the things that I said to him, we have all these independent analyses of hare that have come back as unknown. But if these are coming from a single species, those characteristics that are distinguishing these samples and preventing them from being attributed to any known species must be consistent. So let's go back and look at some of those reports. So we actually dug back and contacted some of the labs and found published reports in obscure places, and they were remarkably consistent. They were. So it was suggesting that there were independent hair samples that defied attribution that all had a consistent suite of characteristics that united them with one another. Now, we're almost to a point. I've been working with Henner, and since he's now in retirement, he has more fun looking through his telescope than he does through a microscope these days. But we're working on putting together a final paper to summarize his work and what I have done since his retirement on the basis of the morphology. Because being an anatomist as opposed to a molecular biologist, you can't just simply ignore the morphology in lieu of wanting to have the DNA. The morphology says something. I mean, like I said, these hair exist. And they're from some animal. And if we can't put our finger on it right now, that suggests that there's some novel unknown animal out there. So we'll be working on that over the coming years to get that published. And I hope, hopefully, that'll be a first step. But as far as the DNA, as far as any of this establishing the identity or establishing the reality of the species, for most skeptics out there, it's going to take a specimen on the slab in front of them before they'll acknowledge. Because even with DNA, it becomes indirect. You have a published sequence of numbers. You don't have a photograph of the physical remains of a creature of any type. And so they'll always, given what they perceive as the extraordinary nature of this phenomenon, this proposition, they'll want the utmost in evidence to establish its existence.
Yeah, what I have to say is sort of echoed that. The truth is the NAWAC is a conservation group. This is not an academic question for us. We're not trying to figure out a new and novel way of establishing a species. If you look at aerial surveillance and photography of the wild areas of this country, you see what's happened to them over the past several decades. We don't have a lot of time. So we're not trying to come up with the most interesting way of establishing this exotic new primate in North America. We're trying to establish the primate in North America so we can do our job, which is to conserve them in their environment. The most efficient way to do that is to bring back a body or a piece of a body. There may be other ways. And if we happen upon one of those ways in the course of our work, for instance, the blood samples that we found on the rock, if that had done it, we would have been thrilled, we would have been done. But the fact is, we have a mission, and that's to conserve the animal and its environment. And the most efficient way to do that, and we believe there is a clock ticking, the most efficient way to do that is to bring in a specimen. One second.
So y'all advocate killing it?
I do.
Is that what y'all are saying?
I absolutely do.
What about live specimens?
I'd take a live specimen.
Like dig a hole next to the cabin and they walk by?
Yeah, if I could figure out a way to do it. Yeah, sure. Conservation is not about individuals. Conservation is about populations of animals. Conservationists are interested in an entire population of the species. That's what conservation is all about. Dr. Meldrum talked about, the old way of shooting first, asking questions later. But, I mean, there are still many, many wild biologists who say, I mean, he
Brian brought up three examples this morning of wildlife biologists who said you must have a type specimen. It's unpleasant for some people, but that is just the way it is. You've got to have a type specimen. Because for all intents and purposes, right now this is the Texas Unicorn Conference. That's what this is to most of the world. And until there can be a body lying on this table to present to science, academia, and the world, we may as well be talking about leprechauns and unicorns and minotaurs. And that's just the heartfelt truth. So...
So what are you implying about leprechauns? Where are
you? You can find a little green scat, maybe you could use that too. There's a question in the back.
My only question on that was, more than likely, you'll end up taking out an alpha male from a plant, which is going to have a negative impact on the survivability of the rest of the...
If the population cannot sustain the loss of one individual, it's doomed anyway.
Well, I understand that.
Yeah.
My question is, the people involved are more than likely accomplished marksmen. Is there, and I know there are complications with refrigeration of trank darts, but has there been any discussion of tranquilizers?
Yes. Yeah, oh, yeah, sure.
And complete
sure.
Use of the...
So the, with regard to the alpha male question, this is a group of individuals, and based on our observations, we don't know for sure, but based on our observations, we believe that there are multiple animals, and we also believe... that if in case it is driven by an alpha male, if their social structures are surrounding an alpha male, there are probably other animals, based on our observations and our beliefs, there are other animals that will step up. So it isn't that if we take one, we're destroying 12. We don't think that's the case. Secondarily, with regard to tranquilizers are tricky business. You know, this is a technology that's been developed for animal husbandry. For tranquilizing animals that are in pens, that you know how much they weigh and exactly how much sedative to use. What would likely happen in the case of us using a tranquilizer gun is either we miss the thing entirely because you don't have the same velocity of a tranquilizer dart that you do a lead slug. Either nothing would happen, or we'd hit the thing and it would run off and either get a little queasy and then get mad at us because we made it sick, or it would fall asleep peacefully and. But we don't know where it is, so we can't pick it up. Or it would die because we gave it too much sedative. So there is, again, we're not saying there is no other way. We're saying that we have a mission to fulfill, and we're trying to accomplish the most efficient way of doing that. We don't have unlimited resources. The other thing that we looked at with tranquilizer technology is it's expensive. You know, the rifles are expensive. The stuff you put in them is expensive. And to your point, a lot of it has to be refrigerated. So it sounds great to talk, well, maybe we can dig a hole. Then you've got a problem. We've got an 800-pound, pissed-off, 8-foot-tall thing in a hole. The hole has to be 16 feet deep just to keep it from coming out and killing you, right? And then what do you do with it, right? What are you going to... Can you just fill this vial and pass it back up? I mean, you've got... So you've got all these things that just logistically are, and I have a very good friend, some of you may be aware of him, who says, well, you're just trying to take the easy way out. And there's a difference between ease and efficiency. And that's really what it boils down to.
I'd like to add just one brief thing about the tranquilization question. My background in the movies, I've worked very extensively, not just with people, but I've probably done more makeup effects on animals than any other makeup artist in Hollywood. And on one particular film, you might know it was called The Beastmaster. Mark Singer and Tanya Roberts made around 83. There's a big black giant leopard in there, which is nothing more than a tiger who is dyed black. Okay. Ralph Helfer was the owner of the animals. We had four tigers that we were going to use. I was on the team that dyed the tigers black. We used three boxes of Lady Clairol number one black to do each tiger. We started with the first one, which is a tiger named Sultan. He was about 300, 350 pounds thereabouts. He was their best tiger. I'd even gone into a cage with him myself. I'd walked him and everything. He was an amazing tiger. But the two veterinarians who were there, and these are both exotic animal veterinarians, they looked at him in his cage and said, yeah, he looks like he's about 350. And they set their tranquilizer dose for that. They tranquilized him, put him down, dyed him black, and we only found out afterwards they had over-tranquilized him. He never fully came back up. He lingered for about 2 weeks, and he died. And this was their best tiger, and he was truly a wonderful cat. I literally knew him personally. But the tragedy was that even with two trained veterinarians who do exotic animals, and an animal right there 10 feet away from you, to you try and gauge his weight so you can calculate the method of the dosage of the tranquilizer. You get it off, you'll lose the animal, or it won't go down enough. It's that delicate. So the idea of just looking at a beast and saying, well, he looks pretty big, let's use 50 cc's, and you load it in the gun and you shoot on it, your chances of being the right amount of tranquilization to be effective, I'd give it about 1%. Realistic.
But it looks so easy on TV.
Well, this is the point, though, that I was going to make, and then we can wrap this up. But my analogy around this is for people who don't know anything about firearms, a gun is a gun is a gun is a gun, right? I have a gun, so I can shoot anything and kill it. And the reality is, of course, a .22 is different than a... I mean, they're not all the same. And all of these other alternatives, for instance, tranquilization technology, is complicated. We don't know anything about that. And the amount of money and time we would spend buying all this stuff, trial and error, and then probably not getting anything again anyway, it's just not, it's outside our reach. It's outside of what we can do. And again, to put a exclamation point on it, we're a conservation group. We're trying to achieve a goal, and every day that we don't is a day that our goal may be unachievable. We're one day closer to that. So we're trying to get to our goal. And we're going to get there the most efficient way we can. We're not going to go there in a straight line. If there's another way, we'll do it. But we're going to get there the most efficient way we can.
Very good. Josh Gates, how do you choose your next investigation site, and where are you going to go next?
Well, we look for, first and foremost, places where there are good stories that are recent and relevant. We don't want to go investigate a cryptid that nobody claims to have seen in the last, 1,000 years. We're not going to go look for a dragon. We want to go to a place where we can meet people that have had current experiences. And I think from a storytelling perspective, if you look at it from the TV angle, if you're a viewer of Destination Truth and you don't necessarily believe in Creature X, but I can introduce you to a credible, sane person who has a really compelling story about an encounter, that's a compelling way in for many of our viewers. So we want to go to a place where there is a good story, that's a shame because it would be more fun just to go to, tropical islands and just pick fun places to go to. But really, for us, it's about something that feels like it has some heat on it.
Do you have input into where are you going, or is that just...
No, we do all of that ourselves. So it's a very small group of people that makes make the show, and I've said this earlier today, one of the cheats in the show is that it looks like we go do our investigation and we fly all the way home to talk to Jeff here. We don't do that. We typically leave Los Angeles, and we will stay in the field for 2 to 3 months filming, and we'll usually go all the way around. And then when we come back, we film all of those expert interviews at the end. It's just like economically possible. So when we try to create a route, it's about finding those good stories, but it's also about tying them together in an around-the-world ticket that makes sense. You don't want to have too many up and downs. You don't want to go from Tierra del Fuego, to Northern Europe so you have to try to create a route that is works within the TV production as well. So we design that, and then we march it up to Sci-Fi. I always speak in a couple kind of bucket list things in there if I can, and we see what they like and what they respond to, and we take it from there. But it's really a group effort of trying to figure out the places that we want to go.
Do you know where you're going to go next?
I don't. I was saying earlier, I just finished up producing this new series, and so now we're just getting back into the conversation of Destination Truth. I know where I'd like to go. I'd like to go to Tibet. That's an area of the Himalayas that we haven't visited yet. There's a little bit more leniency with the paranormal stories. The because there's usually good ghost stories everywhere. So I have this list of things that I march up there every year. Every year I say, let's go to Iraq and do like, you know, like a Saddam's haunted palace story. And they're like, no, we're not with the Iraqi again. We're not going to Iraq. And I wanted to do like a Titanic, you know, Russian submersible ghost investigation. Expensive, it turns out. You know, we've got kind of our wish list, and some of those have come true. The, you know, Antarctic trip that we did had been on there for a long time, and we finally got the channel to invest in that. So it's a combination of kind of wish list stuff, but more it's driven by recent stories.
And this is, next question's addressed basically to group members here. It says, there are many sightings that are never documented. How come there are not more cameras running by the researchers themselves? I assume that means even maybe on them, as in a GoPro or something like that.
Oh, can I talk that real quick?
I thought you might want that.
I had a GoPro strapped to my head this summer, and it gave me the worst headache I've ever had in my entire life. You know, there's a way to do it if you're on a TV show, and I know that Josh knows this, with the articulated thing and all that. But then it's looking at the person. We've spent some time thinking about putting cameras on our people so that we can film what they're seeing. And again, there are some issues with that too. One of them is keeping everything charged. Electricity is a huge problem for us. Keeping all the batteries going and keeping the cameras filled with cards. Actually, Ken Helmer had a sighting. He had a GoPro on his head because he wanted to do this. And this is the Bigfoot curse, but he had a brief sighting. He had a sighting, but he saw it twice. It came out and it went out and came back again. And he's like, I got a camera on my head. And the camera had died like 15 minutes before he saw this. Because he'd been sitting in the blind all day long with his damn camera on his head. And the battery had gone dry, because that's what they do. So we are doing that. I plan on having the camera back on my head again this summer. And anybody else who will do it can have a camera strapped to their head too. But it's not as simple, again, as just strapping a camera on your head and seeing the whole world. It's difficult.
Maybe I have to do that too.
You know, we've played around with, I think, every portable camera we can find on Destination Truth, and we disassemble them, and we actually have been fortunate enough to work with the NBC News crew in New York, since they're part of the, you know, Sci-Fi's part of the NBC Universal family, and they've developed all sorts of, you know, really neat little board cameras and hidden cameras for, you know, police and, you know, investigative journalism stuff. The problem with looking outward as opposed to looking inward with anything that's infrared, if we're talking about at night, is it's very hard to generate enough throw so that the camera sees anything. It's fine when you're looking back and your subject is always 2 feet or, you know, from the camera that sits on that swing arm that looks back at us. But when you turn that camera around at night, it doesn't matter if you modify, we modify our GoPros to let them run in infrared, but it doesn't matter, you have to use such an enormous amount of infrared light, unless you walk up to a tree, to see anything out in open space. And so in order to really, and that infrared light is visible, you can see it, it's very sort of distracting for wildlife. But so the, you know, night vision is still the best solution for looking forward. And we use astroscopes and military-grade stuff, which we mount to our cameras. And it's bulky, and it's big, and it's expensive, and it's finicky still. It's not all that easy to work with. It's not very... my camera guys on the show hate working with these astroscopes because they do light up the night, and you can see a lot, but they're not this big. They're big cameras still that you... need to walk around, but they do use a lot of power. So, infrared has come a long way, but night vision is still, unless you're working with extremely high-end stuff, but even then, it's not hyper-portable.
I thought I had it all figured out 2 years ago, and I found the maybe the best civilian-grade night vision that you can get. What's it called? The Mini 14, and I paid extra for the really good bulk, because apparently how this stuff works is these sensors come out, they come down the line, and they're all within a range of being good, better, best, and I paid extra for that really good one. I paid an astoundingly stupid amount of money for this thing, because I'm like, I'm going to see a Bigfoot with this thing.
And I also, because it also said you can thread it to a camera. It's hard to do that. This stuff, none of this stuff is designed to work together, right? And so I've got this beautiful piece of night vision equipment that absolutely just lights up the night. But, you know, dark is still dark. A shadow is still a shadow. And you can't see everything, even with that stuff. So it helps, but it's not perfect.
What about thermal?
Thermal is an order of magnitude more expensive. I actually think that, you know, there's a couple of technologies that are coming down the line that may help us in the future. Thermal is one of them. It's getting cheaper. It's sort of like night vision used to be, you know, a car or a night vision unit, and now it's like an old junky car or a night vision unit. You know, so it's getting cheaper and more accessible. But the two other things, thermal, as it becomes more inexpensive, and they are getting more expensive. But even the cheapest passable one is like $3,000 or $4,000 at this point. The other thing, I was just at South by Southwest and I sat in a panel about drone technology and DIY drone technology and what you can do and what you're allowed to do and what the government doesn't want you to do, but mounting camera packages to drones and how that technology is becoming more and more inexpensive. And these things are almost autonomous. You draw a box on a map, it stays in that box. That's really exciting stuff. It's outside our ability at this point, but I honestly think we're 5 years away from being able to deploy drones in our research area. And of course, Dr. Melderman is working on a project that's very similar to that in sort of intention.
And, you know, as a nonprofit organization, that's what your money in coming to this conference goes to. As a 501c3, we're required by the federal government to pour every penny of that back in to the mission statement. And that's what we're doing. You're talking about thermals. That's what your money, hopefully, will go to. Surveillance systems, more technology to help. So you're doing a good thing by coming here and helping us.
I have a question. You touched base on, you know, there's not a lot of people out that can find these things. With that statement having been set, granted, do you have in your research and the changes that y'all are doing internally into the changes to conservancy, do you have a protocol, as you said, or a setup, should someone, the average hunter person, actually stumble upon, let's say they or they have accidentally shot one, do you have a protocol, a hotline, or a setup in place that you can actually walk an average person how to harvest that tissue and how to store it, preserve it, or get somebody there so that this opportunity doesn't go away?
Well, we have our website, and that would be the quickest way to contact us. I don't know that we have anything drawn up that walks a particular individual.
What I'm saying is a contact. Say, hey.
With the protocol... The only thing that would change about our protocol in the collection of a specimen would be the collector. I mean, if it were a hunter who shot one and they contacted us, we would likely handle it the same exact way, except the originator, the collector, would be different. Of course, we would have to have, you know, the acquiescence of that person. They would have to agree to allow us to follow through with our protocol on it, but it would largely be the same thing, you know, with the exception of who originated it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. And I just want to say, I've always wanted a hotline. I want that red phone on my desk.
It would never stop ringing.
That would be so awesome.
You would be screwed with more than a day. It would never end. It would never stop ringing. I would call it. If you, that's it. I mean, all day long, people would mess
with it. Shut up, Josh. Give me
right.
Okay, we're quickly running out of time, so we'll make this the final question. I think this could be very interesting. It's addressed to the whole panel. What's the scariest thing you've ever encountered in the woods?
Pot growers. Honestly, when you're out doing pot growers, when you're out doing archaeological surveys and you hit their trip wires, I'm more afraid of man than I am.
Where is that?
Yeah,
say Josh Gates. vocalizations, I guess, when you hear really loud, close, prolonged vocalizations, that can be pretty intimidating.
When you're in the airplane?
I think that counts for this question. come back to me. Thank you.
I guess I'd have to say that there were times when we have were using a tentage that wasn't modified, so you could observe from inside, and that feeling of being inside a little bitty tent and not knowing what's literally 2 feet away from you, brushing against the rain fly, that was a little bit unnerving.
I don't have hardly any experience in the outdoors, quote unquote. I've been a city boy all my life. The very rare times when I've actually been in anything that could be called outdoors, especially at night, where I can't see civilization, you know, by just looking around. The only scary thing that I actually can recall is drunken humans.
That was scary.
I mean, I can think of a few scary times. Sometimes it's what you don't see that can really scare you, and your imagination can take over. One time I was out near Tyler, Texas, and I had a girlfriend that had a lot of land out there, and we drove up and down the roads at night, and I'm generally not scared of anything. We would go out in these areas, a lot of old graveyards out there, and, you know, I wasn't afraid of ghosts or anything, and we were in graveyards, and that's kind of spooky. But I was walking up really towards the back, and we didn't really have any flashlights. There was enough moonlight, but it was pretty dark. You couldn't see very far, and there was a lot of trees on this overgrown area of the graveyard. Walked up to this back fence. It was surrounded by a chain link fence. I stood there, and there was something over there, and I just heard this low grunt or a growl, and it just... And I couldn't tell if that creature was 4 feet long or 8 foot tall. I don't know what it is, but at that point I thought, we've done our looking around in this. I had it right out of there. I never saw what it was, but it was very scary because I couldn't see what it was.
The scariest thing that's ever happened to me actually didn't happen to me. It happened to Mark McClurkin. It was the story that he was retelling in the video, and I was on that team with the when that actually happened to him. And I had the other radio. I was the one he was calling when he called for help. And I was too far away. And I knew, the scariest part was I knew he needed assistance. And I could not get to him. And the people who were closer to him did not have a radio and did not know he needed it. So that was the scariest thing. I was not in danger, but he was. And as I was trying to get there as fast as I could, I heard his gunshots. I heard a fire. And I knew that something very serious was happening. And I could not help it. That was the scariest thing that's ever happened to me.
I have three things. September 2005, Alton Higgins and I were in a tent, and we heard something mere feet from us that sounded like a black howler monkey that was 10 feet tall. That, I was extremely unnerved at that situation. And then last year, when I saw the individual we referred to as Old Gray, when I first saw Old Gray, I was not unnerved. I was not unnerved until Rick Hayes came back. And Rick Hayes attempted to replicate the movement of Old Gray. And it was at that point that I realized the extreme size of this individual. Because when I first saw it, I really didn't have a frame of reference. But when Rick came and stood, tried to stand where it stood, where it walked, Rick's 5'9", and this thing just dwarfed him. And I got really unnerved at that point. And then later on, Mike Mays and I, this is another team, Mike Mays and I were sitting out in front of the cabin, and it was about 10 o'clock. This was the last night of Operation Persistence. We were winding it down. We were going to close the operation down. Mike Mays and I are sitting there at the campfire. It's pretty quiet, about like this. And all of a sudden, we hear this massive boulder just... chucked. It was in the creek behind us, which is flat. There's no mountain there. There's nowhere for a rock to dislodge and fall. It was behind us probably 100 yards. And you know, the thought occurred to me, if this thing can pick up a rock that size, there's no telling. I mean, what if it decides to do that to this cabin? And we're in here, lying inside the cabin. And the wheels start turning in. And we've been there 8 days, so you're already fatigued. So all these physiological problems you're having, you're starting to wail as well. And then when you hear this, Mike and I both, we sort of tucked our tails between our legs and we went into the cabin, and it was a long night after that.
And we were out of a change of underwear by that time. It was a dicey night.
I think for me, it's I don't have a lot of comfort around snakes at night, and so places where we have been where there are very dangerous snakes, and we're sort of clomping around, you've got camera guys walking backwards and all those kind of things. We've had a lot of, we've been very lucky on Destination Truth. We've had a couple of very close calls with snakes at night. We had a pit viper one night that was in a tree at eye level that kind of came out when my camera guy went past it. And that kind of stuff is scary because we, you know, it's like we're an 8-person crew and we don't have this big off-camera, you know, safety crew there. And that gets scary when you're in very remote places.
Gosh, the episode where your camera guy got yanked in the field, that seemed like y'all and you were pretty jolted about that one.
But that was certainly his scariest night, I think, for sure. He was really shaken up by that. We had a camera guy in this haunted forest thing we did who was not a paranormal believer at all. Camera guy out there to do a job and something happened to him and he got knocked off his feet. I've worked with him for years and I've never seen him so much as say anything about the paranormal, and he was crying and really scared. So, it's amazing how that people just, something just happens and your whole world kind of goes upside down.
Think that's it?
All right, well, I guess I'll go back to being the MC now. And thank you very much. I'll tell you, before we end here, this was, if we can answer questions, we do have to get out of here. This is probably the best attended Texas Bigfoot conference in like 6 or 7 years. It may be the best attended one ever. We're not real sure. We don't have it sort of on stone tablets for the old days. But anyway, thank you so much for coming. It's been a huge success.